Join me in Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1. In fact, you can just leave your Bible laying open right at that place. We're not going anywhere else this morning. I went by and saw my mom on Friday. She'd been in the hospital while we were away. We were checking up on her. And as we sat around and caught up, having been apart for a couple of weeks, we started reminiscing about the years we enjoyed together as family. And the conversation reminded me of the blessing of family. I know it always doesn't seem that way day by day. No one knows the flaws and weaknesses of each other more than family does, right? And sometimes we lose sight of the blessing of this fundamental unit of culture that God created, this fundamental piece of His order. We need to remember the blessing of family. You know that I have moms in mind, especially today, and the vital role that they play. I think culture has lost sight of that too. What happens in families, brothers and sisters, is just among the very most important things that are happening on the planet. And the role of a godly wife and mother is a vital contribution to all of that. And so we celebrate moms today and express our gratitude to them. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms in the crowd. I would also invite you today, if you would, to consider that not everybody celebrates today. That in fact, for some, days like today are days of grief and sorrow. Sometimes because mom is already gone. And rather than flowers and lunch out, it's memories and tears. Other moms have wayward kids, and so there won't be any cards or phone calls today because that relationship is damaged. And some moms have lost their kids. And we've recently gone through that in this church family. And so I think it's good to think about that. And at seasons like this, to be sensitive to members of our family who have different emotions and feelings on a day like today. I hope you'll ponder that. How about one other little bit of business I want to take care of this morning before we get into Philippians 1. It's been after months of interviews and conversations that the elders have extended an offer to Andrew Green to join our family as a preaching intern. And I'm happy to say today that Andrew has accepted that offer. He comes to us from the Southside Church in Pasadena. And for longtime members of the Kleinwood Church family, you will want to know that he comes with Bubba's enthusiastic recommendation. That means something to the folks here. Andrew is a graduate of the University of Houston, which also means something to a few of you here, with a degree in media and production. After spending a lot of time with him, Jeff and Randy and I are convinced that he is eager to learn more about preaching the gospel effectively. And we are excited for the opportunity to begin working with him on July 1st. And so, this work continues on. A work that, I don't know, Jeff, more than two decades now, the Kleinwood Church has been invested in taking young men and doing what we can to prepare them to go other places and preaching the gospel. Think about what's happening in Sinton, Texas right now, this morning. And so now we continue that work. I have been so grateful for the way that this family generously supports the young men who come and spend this time with us. And I invite you to think about Andrew and how you can be an encouragement to him. He is sitting right down there next to my wife this morning. Andrew, would you stand up so everybody knows who you are? We are happy that you are going to be joining us in July. I should mention that Andrew's dad is with him today too, Paul. Paul, we're really glad that you're here today as well. Hope you're excited about that. Hope you'll be praying for him. Okay, I'm ready now. Philippians chapter 1. Jeff, don't start my time till right now, buddy. So I want to read a little bit of this first chapter for you. I ask you to read along with me. And then I just want us to talk a little bit, unpack this text a little bit this morning. Verse number 12 is where I'll start. Paul writes, "Now I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. And that most of the brethren, trusting in the Lord because of my imprisonment, have far more courage to speak the word of God without fear. Some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, but some also from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition rather than pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in this I rejoice." Yes. "And I will rejoice, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope that I will not be put to shame in anything, but that with all boldness, Christ will even now as always be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain." Philippian letter has always been a little odd to me. On the one hand, it is clear as Paul is writing this letter that he is dealing with some extraordinarily unpleasant circumstances. You may have noticed in verse number 13, he alludes to his imprisonment. In fact, he mentions that a couple of times right there in that segment of the letter. So he writes from jail. And I just have to tell you, I don't know anything about first century jails. I imagine they're not quite as cushy as jails today. But nonetheless, rather miserable circumstances, I think, for anybody. Nobody wants to be in jail. But I have wondered if that wasn't exceptionally more difficult for a guy like Paul. Will you hang with me on this one? I mean, Paul was always on the go. He was not a homebody, right? This guy spent his time traveling the world looking for new places to plant the gospel and to reach lost souls and to build congregations up. And then as he did that, he also would go back and follow up and deal with problems and write letters and try to encourage people. And this guy always was on the go, always had an agenda, always looking for the next place, and now he can't go. And for a guy like Paul, it just seems like that would have been extraordinarily frustrating. But that's not his only problem. Because if you look at verse number 17, he goes on to say that some of his own brethren, while he is in prison, are making trouble for him. It's just rain, folks, okay? I know, I hear it too. I know it's not what anyone's been praying for, but nonetheless, there it is. I have to tell you that I'm curious about what was going on with this group in verse 17. Why were they doing this? And what's behind all of that? What motivated all of that? And it's one of those places where the scripture just doesn't satisfy our curiosities. We just know that these guys are making trouble for Paul while he is in prison. So what he says in verse 12, when he references my circumstances, that's what he's talking about. He's kind of in a mess. But that's the odd thing about this letter. You would think, coming from a guy in jail that there'd be a lot of moaning and groaning over circumstances. Listen, I've corresponded with lots and lots of guys in jail over the years. And I have to tell you, I just have folders and folders of letters from guys complaining and griping about how lousy their circumstances were. That's the odd thing about Philippians. So Paul doesn't do that. In fact, if you've studied the letter before, you've probably come to associate the word joy with this letter because he talks a lot about his joy. He starts with that. Are you still in chapter 1? Look up at verse 3. After his standard introduction, this is how he starts. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always offering prayer with joy in my every prayer for you, in view of your participation in the gospel from the first day until now. He said, when I think about you guys and pray about you guys, I am just filled up with joy. Y'all give me so much joy. Don't you think that's an odd thing for a guy to say who's in prison? And then later, when we get down to verse 12, where we began reading, he starts giving this upbeat, positive assessment of what's happening to the gospel and all the people that are hearing about Jesus. In fact, that's just kind of the tenor of this first chapter as you make your way through it. And then when you go on through the book, he just talks all the time about reasons he's joyful and reasons that they ought to be joyful as well. So it does stir up a question, doesn't it? How could Paul talk so much about joy? How could he personally be filled with joy in the middle of such lousy circumstances? I think we find some answers to that in chapter 1, and that's what I want us to dig around and look for this morning. But don't miss how that impacts me and you, because I think we struggle with this. How can we find that same kind of joy that Paul talks about and Scripture talks about when sometimes our circumstances are kind of lousy too? How do we do that? And again, I think the answer can be found here in chapter 1. And so let me begin with this. I think if you look carefully at chapter 1, one of the things that you see is Paul found joy in his labor. He found joy in his work. In fact, let me just say to you this morning that as I read this chapter, one of the things that occurs to me is that Paul's circumstances, his personal predicament, that is not his primary focus. That is not what he is thinking about. There is something else, another agenda that is even more important to him than his personal situation. Now, can I just say to y'all this morning that for a lot of people, that would be a really strange idea. Will you guys see that with me? Because I think for most people, life is all about their personal situation. And whether life is good or bad is all about how I am doing, how it is with me. Can I give you a little quick illustration of that? If I had my phone up here with me this morning, and I don't do that because Stephen Peters texts me when I'm preaching, but if I had my phone up here this morning and I could get far enough back to take a picture of all of you and then texted back to Kendricks, and then he threw it up on the slide. When I put the picture of this audience up on the slide, what's the first thing you'd look at? Yeah, I know, because I do too. When there's a picture and I'm in it, the first thing I do is look at me. And it's not really because I want to look at me. It's because I want to make sure my face doesn't look dumb in the picture, right? You too? The first thing we look at is ourselves when we look at a picture that we're in. In fact, it's probably worse than that for most of us. Most of us probably judge whether the picture is good or bad based on how we look, right? If I look good in that picture, it's a good picture, right? In fact, maybe you have made the mistake that I have made a few times of looking at a picture of me and my wife together and saying to her, "Hey, that's a really great picture." To which she responds, "Did you look at me? My eyes are closed. I have a goofy smile on my face. How can you say that? Then I'm in trouble," right? I think a lot of people look at life like they look at pictures. It's all about how things are with me. We tend to get consumed with self. That's why we get mad at the guy who drives slow in the left lane. Right? Because he's messing with my agenda. I've got places to be. I've got stuff to do. He needs to get out of my way. Right? We never pause and think, "I wonder why he's going slow." Maybe it's an older person, a little less sure of their driving now, or a younger person who's not quite learned how to do it yet. They're a little nervous about it. So they're going, "We don't think about that. We think about, get out of my way. I need to go. I got stuff to do." You see it? So I threw myself under the bus too. That's what's odd about Paul in Philippians 1. That doesn't seem to be how he's operating. It doesn't seem to be that his focus is on his situation. That there is something else even more important to him. And I would contend, brothers and sisters, that is his labor in the gospel. He is consumed with that thought. In fact, he's so focused on it that he's even able to celebrate his suffering because it is contributing to the spread of the gospel. Watch that in verse number 12. Notice that Paul says, "My circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel." What does he mean when he talks about that? My circumstances. Well, he says it in verse 13. My imprisonment. That's the situation. My imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and everyone else. Now, again, I'm curious. I want to know what's going on with all of that. I'm wondering if somehow Paul's imprisonment had given some notoriety to the gospel and to Jesus. And so now there's talk about this prisoner and discussion about Jesus in Rome. There's conversation about that. He certainly goes on to say in verse 14 that there are other preachers who are more bold now. They've seen me in jail and I'm still doing my labors for the Lord. And so they're emboldened by that and they're doing things for the Lord. And now the gospel's just being proclaimed courageously. Paul's happy about that. What's really bizarre is that even in the evil tactics of those causing him trouble, he finds a reason to celebrate. Remember, are you still in chapter 1? Look at verse 17. The former proclaimed Christ at a selfish ambition rather than for pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. There are these guys making trouble for him. Their motives are wicked, but their message is true. Verse 18, what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. They're still preaching the true gospel. And so what does Paul say? In this I will rejoice. I'm just happy that people are hearing the message. You see, what mattered most to Paul was not his personal comfort, that everything in his situation just be right. He was consumed with the proclamation of the gospel. And when that's happening, he's joyful. So he celebrates that here in chapter 1. But I think his joy goes deeper than that. It isn't just in his labor that he celebrates. I want to suggest, secondly, that it's also in the deeper purpose that drives that labor, the purpose of Paul's life. So let's think about that a little bit. And let me begin by pitching you this question. What if I ask you this morning, what do you want more than anything else in life? Will you think about that question? What would your answer be? What do you want more than anything else in life? Want to have some fun? Ask that question to a group of teenagers. I did that years ago, had about 20 kids in a living room doing a Devo, and that was my question to him. I said, what do you guys want more than anything else in life? And this young girl raised her hand immediately before anyone else spoke, and she said, I want to marry a doctor. I know, I was curious where that came from too. And I said, you need to help us with that. Explain it a little. She said, well, my dream is to live in a big house in the country with stables and horses that I can ride every day. And I figure if I'm going to have that, I got to marry someone that makes a lot of money. So my plan is to marry a doctor. Well, I was impressed at such a young age. She had it all figured out, right? Some of the boys said that what they wanted more than anything was to play basketball for the Lakers. And I was thinking, have you looked at your dad's height? I think you're being optimistic, right? One guy had a very vivid description of the car that he dreamed of owning. More than anything in life, he wanted that car. That's where the conversation began with that group. What about you? How would you answer that question? What do you want more than anything in life? If you're single, maybe the answer is a spouse. I'd like to get married. If you're in school, maybe the answer is to be done. I was talking to a girl yesterday, just finished a semester, and she said, I have one more to go. You could hear it. She's so eager to be done. Or if you're done with school and starting your career, maybe your desire is to get to the place you want to be in your career, or to get to the place where you want to be and economically. And I know some of you Astro fans are saying, I just want to win. Just one, right? Maybe it's more noble than that. I just want a good family. I want my kids to serve the Lord. What do you want more than anything? What did Paul want? How did he see his purpose? Will you look back at verse 18, chapter 1, when he's talking about these guys who are creating trouble for him, and he says, what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in this I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice. Now watch this beginning at 19. For I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that I will not be put to shame in anything, but with all boldness, watch this, Christ will even now as always be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. Paul said, what I want to do with my life is exalt Christ. So I was curious about that. And I went out and I looked up the word exalt to see what the scholar said about that. And at least one scholar said that exalt means to make great. If you're reading from the old King James, instead of exalt, it might use the word magnify. My purpose is to magnify Christ, to make Christ great, which frankly sounds like a tall order for any person, even a person as great as Paul. How do you and I make Christ great? Well, obviously, coming at it from one angle, there's nothing that I can do as a person that adds to the greatness of Christ. Christ is who he is. But I tell you what we can do is we can help other people see how great Christ is. Because brothers and sisters, they don't know. Lots of people don't know who he really is, and they don't know what he's done for humanity, and they don't recognize how desperately they need that. In our world today, to so many people, Christ is small. And our task is to magnify him for a world who doesn't see him for what he is, to help them see Christ for who he is. Paul says, that's my purpose. That's why I breathe, so that I can magnify Christ. Now we understand the labor, right? This is what's underneath that passion for the spread of the gospel. It is the preaching of the gospel that magnifies Christ, that holds him up and says to other people, this is who he is. And this is what he has done. And this is why you desperately need it. In fact, Paul is so bought into that. That's so important to him. Look at the end of verse 20 and notice what he says. That purpose so consumes me that if I can exalt Christ by continuing to live, even though I'd rather be with Jesus, then God, let me live and do your work and proclaim your message. But Paul says, if I can best exalt you before other men by giving my life and dying, then let me die. Because this is my purpose, to hold him up and help other people see how great he is. And so that's why Paul celebrates even from a prison cell. Why? Because as Christ is proclaimed, Christ is exalted, and Paul's reason for breathing is satisfied. Maybe you already get where this is going now. Because if that's his purpose, there's still something underneath all of that, isn't there? Really, brothers and sisters, Paul's joy is rooted in this person. It's rooted in Jesus. Now, verse 21. Paul says that for me, to live is Christ. Everything about his life came down to this person. So much so that he could say that. Think about the power of that statement in verse 21. For to me, to live is Christ. So here's a question I have to wrestle with when I read that, and especially when I understand it in the context of chapter 1. The question I have to wrestle with is, can I honestly say the same thing about me? That my life is Christ. I think all of us want to give Jesus a place in our life, right? Can I illustrate that this way? So in our life, we have all these different relationships, right? I've got a relationship with my wife. We have a relationship with our children. We have relationships with all of you. We have relationships with our next door neighbors. I have a relationship with Jeff because he and I are stuck with each other every day. Your coworkers, you have relationships with all these relationships in life, right? And then along with those relationships, our lives include all these responsibilities that we have as well. So if you have a job, you've got a responsibility to your employer, things they expect from you. We've got responsibilities to our community. If you're going to school, maybe some of y'all are thinking about that because it's the end of the semester, finals are coming. You've got some responsibilities there you've got to take care of. And so life is all about these relationships and all the responsibilities that come with them, right? And here's what we want to do with Jesus. We want to add Jesus to the list, right? In fact, I knew y'all wouldn't be satisfied if I just stuck his name up there. So I put it at the top and made the letters bigger and bolder because that's what we would want to say, right? Oh, no. Jesus isn't just another relationship. He's the most important relationship. He goes at the top of my list. So here's my question. Is that picture right? Is that how life ought to be? I put Jesus on my list and I say he's the most important thing on my list. What's wrong with that picture is that Jesus is only an item on the list. And the problem with that is, brothers and sisters, is sometimes when he's only an item on the list, we gather at places like this and we sing songs like, "Oh, how I love Jesus," but then we go to work on Monday and we do some things that would probably cause some people to say, "Really?" That picture's wrong. It's wrong because Jesus isn't in the right place. He's not just an item on the list. Brothers and sisters, he is life. And the plan of God is that what Jesus wants then would flow through every other relationship and every other responsibility that we have. He impacts everything. He's the compass, or he sets the compass for everything else that we do in life. And when that doesn't happen, we have problems. Why do people flounder and fail in their marriages? It is because Jesus is only another item on the list. He's not at the center, and his will isn't pulsating through that relationship. Why do people make terrible choices about how they entertain themselves or what kind of clothes they put on? It's because culture determines how we choose our entertainment or how we dress, not Jesus. Our kids struggle spiritually, brothers and sisters, because we have magnified athletes and actors and academics and not Christ in our homes. Our kids need to grow up with this sense that Christ is at the center of everything else that they do, but they can't even come to class with a Bible class lesson done. Christ is not being exalted in our family. The problem is not that we have forgotten him. It's Sunday morning and you're sitting in a church building. The problem is we have forgotten where he belongs. Here's the thing. Until we get him in the right place, we'll never know the joy that Paul is experiencing. In spite of being locked up in a prison and brethren making trouble for him. Not until he's in the right place. And I have to tell you, building my life to look like that and letting Christ reign in everything that I do, listen, maybe if we had to be honest about where we are in our hearts about that, there may be some reluctance to do that. That is dramatic, life-altering change. Here's the thing. Verse 21 already gave us all the incentive we need to build a life that looks like this. Remember what he said in verse 21? "For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain." Jeff said it this morning in the Lord's Supper talk, and we didn't even collaborate. Death is the problem, brothers and sisters, and it squares up with us and looks us right in the eye. We can just sort of bounce through life pretending like there isn't a plot of ground that we're destined for, but every single one of us has an appointment with the grave. Death is the problem. And for the mass of humanity, it will be the greatest human tragedy to die. But that isn't what Paul says in verse 21. He says, "For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain." The two go together. If you take Christ out of the first blank, put anything else you want in there. What do you want most out of life? But then death ceases to be gain. Do you see it? It is only when life is Christ, that death is gain. So, can I say, for me to live is Christ? Maybe if you had to be honest about that this morning, you'd have to admit that you've banished Jesus to some little corner of your life that you visit on the weekends. And it's time to put him back where he belongs. Maybe you did that a long time ago and you haven't held faithful to that commitment. Or maybe you've just never decided to put Christ where he belongs. Let me ask you, how's that working out for you? The only way to make life what it was intended to be is to put Christ where he belongs. So if you need to do that today, more than anything, we want to help you with that. Like Paul, we are passionate about people coming to know Jesus and what he can do for them. So if you need that, if you need to correct things with him this morning, get your life in the right place, we want to help you do that. You can let us know by coming on down to the front this morning while we stand, while we sing.